Tango Tango Popple, 1713, February 7, 2013. Almost said 2012.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Anderson, Indiana. So, let's see. I was up in Wisconsin, and then they had a load that went to Danville, Virginia. And then from Danville, Virginia, I came to Anderson, Indiana. That was today. So right now I'm kind of out of time, had 10 minutes of driving time left, so I'm taking a break, and then after I leave here, I'm heading to the company yard in Indianapolis and get my truck worked on. The A service is due, I believe, but also, there seems to be a bit of a problem with the batteries in conjunction with the bunk heater, because I noticed when it's in really cold weather, the bunk heater is putting out it puts out enough heat, but then the problem is, I guess maybe it's somehow working harder, but it seems like it'll only run if it's really cold and that bunk heater's working. Will run for about 3 hours before, and then that's with the fan on low. It'll run for about 3 hours, and then the battery alarm sounds telling me that I need to start the truck up. So the truck, in other words, the truck is having to idle too much. So there's that, and then there's a few odds and ends, that I've written down that also need fixed. So I'm expecting to probably be in the Indianapolis yard probably a good chunk of the day tomorrow, if not all day. It's hard to say. So that's what's happening there. Right now they're saying, I guess I've heard from a couple of different people that there's going to be a blizzard in the Northeast. I guess it's the Northeast, New York and New Jersey and so on and so forth, are threatened with a giant blizzard. So it's just as well that I'm here and I'm tied up at least all day long. I don't know when the blizzard's supposed to hit hit out there along the coast, but if I'm tied up, and then let's say that they do send me there over the weekend, maybe by the time I get there, they'll have had a chance to kind of clean things up. So I don't know what's going on with that. But in any case, because I really haven't, I'm just going on what people have told me. So as far as that blizzard goes, or the blizzard threat, but in any case, the plan is when I leave here, probably sometime early in the morning, I'll drive on down to Indianapolis, and then I'll be there whenever the shop opens for business. I'm assuming that they'll open at probably 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning. So, but anyway, it's not bad here. It's about 45 degrees, and the weather was pretty decent all day. I left Danville, I don't know, I guess it was about 4 o'clock this morning, 4 a.m. My time. And I got here to Anderson, probably it was about 4 p.m. So, I've stopped a little bit, but mostly, just kind of mostly pushed driving. I had 10 minutes worth of driving time left. So, But anyhow, I've got a voice file that Elena sent me, and she's kind of, I've already listened to it. She's kind of talking about this. It's a kind of a dumb criminal story. So I'm going to go ahead and play that. So here is Elena.
Okay, Tom, I'll make this brief. Haytal is acting up on me, probably because the internet connection here can sometimes be intermittent. Anyway, this is a dumb criminal news story I thought you'd enjoy. And it comes out of Burbank, California, local to me, of course. A man was apprehended by police after he stole 24 quarts of motor oil from the local Costco. He had strapped the bottles of motor oil to his legs, his torso, and his arms. And first of all, can you picture that, Tom? He must have looked like the Stay Puft marshmallow guy or something. 24 quarts. Okay. So obviously he makes it out of the Costco, but I guess an employee with a good eye thought something was up. And so when the police attempted to talk to him, he took off running. Now, remember, Tom, the man has 24 quarts of motor oil strapped to his body. He scales a fence. They don't indicate the height. But personally, regardless, it would be quite a challenge for me to scale a fence with 24 quarts of motor oil strapped to my body. So he scales a fence and loses 9 quarts during the scaling. And so they retrieve 9 quarts. They lose sight of him. Finally, some minutes later, they locate him, and he still has the remaining 15 quarts strapped on him. When questioned as to why he would do this, he said that his job was changing motor oil, so I guess he was some kind of a mechanic or something. It doesn't indicate if he had his own shop or if this is an operation he did on the side, but he cited the high cost of motor oil as his incentive for committing this crime. So, let's see. Now he is going to be charged with theft. Hopefully, Costco will prosecute this man to the fullest extent to discourage other people. He'll have, so he has to pay bail to get himself out. He's charged with the crime. He has to appear in court, so that's loss of presumed wages. Then whatever he has to pay in restitution. Anyway, I hope this gives you a chuckle while you wait for your truck repair. And hopefully you're having a good day and the weather's not too bad. And by all means, if your Haytal is working, you can get back to me on Haytal. All right, Tom, take care. Bye.
Okay, well, thank you, Elena. Now, what she's alluding to, I had my truck worked on, when was it, day before? I guess it might have been the day before yesterday, possibly. I was having light problems on the trailer, and so they ended up running the trailer through the shop, and I think they did some other maintenance to it. And the light problem turned out to be a breaker here in the truck, and so that was actually pretty quick. So, so anyway, that's what she was referring to. So, but anyway, thank you. You know, it's amazing what people will do, and I don't know, they think they're going to get away with it. You know, it's just, there's no end, really, to the dumb criminal stories. There really is no end to it. But, you know, we, all of us, to a certain extent, one extent or another, all of us sort of live with the illusion, and I've talked about this a lot, we live with the illusion that we're our own person, and our motivations are our own, and we originate our own thoughts, and so on and so forth. And I'm telling you, we don't. And it's a difficult thing. You know, even if you intellectually, you can believe me when I say that, you know, in other words, you're suggestible. Even if you can believe that, it's still kind of hard to put two and two together and you know, come up and really come up with four. So in other words, we're way more suggestible than we realize. And so that includes the people around us. If the people, if you know, whoever we've surrounded ourselves with, you know, or either we've surrounded ourselves with, or sometimes, you know, you can't live in a vacuum unless you want to, you know, you go into a monastery and become a monk or whatever, because they can't deal with the world typically. If you surround yourself with people, or you just happen to bump into people, you know, people kind of intrude into your existence, you know, or you just deal with them in public, you can end up being swayed and really, you know, and it's tough to, even with the evidence kind of staring at you in the face, it can be tough to admit to yourself what, you know, that you just acted out of suggestion. Now, this guy with the motor oil, I'd seen a headline somewhere about that. The guy with the motor oil and all the dumb criminal stories, you know, a lot of these people they're kind of broken people. You know, and I'm not making any excuses for them, but they're kind of broken people, and, you know, they're surrounded, you know, they've surrounded themselves, or, you know, they're born into situations where they've got, you know, people around them are sort of a negative influence on them. But even at that, you know, we do have a choice, you know, because let's say that something happens and, you know, you realize that you acted after the fact, you acted foolishly. And, you know, all of us have had that experience, you know, where we've done something foolish and we can see it immediately after the fact. You know, as they say, hindsight is 20/20. But what you have to do is, at that point, if you can, sort of face reality and face the fact, whatever it is, face the fact, if, let's say that you acted, you know, because your friends all suggested that everything was okay, and you were reassured that it's really okay to steal the motor oil, so on and so forth. It's really okay to do that because you don't have any money, and, you know, the Costco's rich and they've got deep pockets, and, you know, or you can come up with a hate Costco thing, or, you know, that people use, or, you know, let's say you're, you know, Walmart, you're shoplifting from Walmart, you know, well, there are people that will sort of use the hate Walmart excuse. Well, they're, you know, they're evil corporation and they're exploiting their employees. Or let's say, you know, let's bring it home for a lot of people. Let's say you steal MP3 files. Let's say you steal MP3 files, you know, of music that's for sale. And then you twist it in your mind and you say, oh, well, the evil record companies, they're screwing the artists and so on and so forth. What you're doing is just, you're trying to justify, you're trying to make a wrong into a right. And more than that, you're trying to kind of justify your own behavior. You know, and you may, you know, your friends may all think that it's okay to steal MP3 files, and you all kind of get together and you kind of, maybe you have an MP3 pride march, and it's, you know, it's okay to steal MP3 files, and so on and so forth. But it's really not. And you know, so you can get together with your you know, like-minded criminal friends, and you know, kind of get them to all agree with you that wrong is right and right is wrong. But it can be extremely painful to have to admit that you acted out of the, you know, pressure or suggestibility, that you acted out of, you know, the people around you sort of pressured you and, you know, kind of made you think that it was okay. And then maybe you think, you know, and then it's easy. We've all got the flaw to varying degrees where we think we're going to get something for nothing. You know, and in the case of the MP3 files, it's like, well, I'm going to get the free MP3 file and I don't have to buy it. And, you know, a lot of times people don't even listen to those things, but they would collect them. I guess they still do that. I think that's just more rampant than ever. Again, I'm not making excuses for the motor oil guy or any of the dumb criminals. I'm not making excuses for them. But, you know, they could either be born into that, you know, where, you know, or they find themselves in that situation, or that's the people they're comfortable with that sort of make them feel that it's okay to do that. But, when you act, the main point I want to make is when you act out of pressure, in your mind, and it can happen just in a split second, that, you know, you'll act out of pressure, but in your mind, something, you know, you'll instantly make the excuse. And the tendency is to instantly make the excuse that you really acted out of your own volition, that it was really your own idea to do whatever it was. You know, and I think our jails are probably full to overflowing, and our jails are kind of overflowing, way more than a lot of other countries are. But, you know, our jails are full of people that acted, you know, they were projected into, and then they couldn't admit that they were wrong. You know, it's not so much, you know, if you do something, if you act out of, and it doesn't have to be some kind of criminal act, but let's say you do something really foolish out of, because you were just pressured, you acted out of pressure. It is painful and it's difficult to admit why you acted, that to be able to see that you acted only you acted because of the pressure, and it can be very painful. But let's say that you got somebody stole something from you, or the classic scam type thing. Let's say you got scammed, and there's plenty of people that get scammed, and it doesn't really matter how intelligent you are, or you may even think you're prepared to not get scammed. And then you end up getting scammed. Well, it's, you know, the lesson, it's not so important, that you got scammed and so on and so forth. That's the real thing is if it can be that negative can be turned into something very positive. That can be turned into a very positive experience if, when you recognize, as soon as you recognize that you got scammed, if you can turn that, if you can look at yourself, even though it's painful, even though it might hurt, if you can look at yourself and really see what you did and see why, and really kind of examine the situation and see why you acted the way you did, and kind of look at all of the different aspects of it and understand why you acted the way you did, then if you can do that and you can be objective about it, and you can't, because the tendency might be to roll your sleeves up and I'm going to fix this and I'm never going to do it again and blah, blah, blah. If you can really look at that and kind of see what it was and feel the embarrassment and so on and so forth, and see what happened, and just be as objective as possible without trying to fix it, then it's worth whatever you got scammed for, or whatever happened, whatever you did acting out of pressure, it's worth it if you can actually see what you did and you are able to handle, the realization and the aftermath of that. If you handle that properly, then it really doesn't matter what happened, as long as you are able to handle it properly. You know, and unfortunately, most people don't handle these things properly, and they tend to go from bad to worse, and so this dumb criminal story, that's probably the story of his life, you know, stealing this and stealing that, and, you know, and he may end up, depending on how old the guy is, you know, he may end up kind of escalating and at some point end up in prison and, you know, so on and so forth. And that, unfortunately, that is a story that goes on and on and on. You know, and it ends up being replicated over and over and over again in our, you know, really, and it's a symptom of a society that is really deteriorating rapidly. So I was, you know, I've got the Audible audiobook. You know, I'm on the plan where I get one a month. And I'm still not, you know, kind of, I've sort of stopped listening to news and so on and so forth. And I'm not even, right now at the moment, I'm not even listening to Rush Limbaugh or even Glenn Beck. Just maybe once in a while I will. So I kind of needed something to listen to. And so I was kind of vaguely aware of it. There's this service. It's completely volunteer. It's called LibriVox, LibriVox, which that's, I don't know, that's probably French for free voice. And what it is, they've got, you know, they've taken books that are, you know, the copyright has expired on them. And, you know, there's, of course, that includes all of the old classics. So they've taken these books that the copyrights have expired on, and people volunteer to basically read the books and create. So it's basically, it's sort of like Audible, it's audiobooks. But these are all completely public domain and free. And so I started listening to some of those, and so I started out, I think I listened, the first one I listened to was Albert Einstein and his theory of relativity, you know, and he had a book, you know, it was kind of a shorter book. And so, but, you know, now in that case, they had two or three different people reading the book. And so it wasn't a single person kind of reading the book. And so the quality, you got to understand, these are not professionals. And so the quality of the reading and so on and the recordings is going to vary somewhat. You know, and some of these people that are reading do, and, you know, some of them do have accents, you know, like this one woman on that, the Albert Einstein book, she had a sort of a heavy, I think like either Scottish or an Irish accent. I couldn't really tell, but it was something along those lines. I could understand her, but it was, you know, it was a little, not the same as an Audible experience. But, you know, you got to understand, this is for free. And so the one I'm listening to right now is a book that I had the PDF file I've had for a while. And I actually had read through part of it on that Nook, the Barnes & Noble Nook. But I guess I didn't realize that I could probably get an audiobook version of it. And so it's called Eugenics by C.K. Chester, or G.K. Chesterton. And it's really, really a great book. So I'm gonna play one of the, this is like chapter 9 from that book, Eugenics by G.K. Chesterton. And so I'm going to play part of this, and for maybe, I don't know, maybe a few minutes worth, and then probably end up cutting it off. But it'll just give you a taste. And now this is it's a pretty decent recording. It's this guy so far. It's a single guy that's read the whole, you know, because I'm up probably 2/3 of the book I listened to today, and I've still got about 1/3 of it left. But so far, it's just this one guy that's probably done the entire book. And so it's a decent recording, you know. But eugenics. You know, of course, this is really, you know, this is a book that's well worth listening to because he goes into all of the arguments, that, you know, kind of, you know, that are sort of swirling around eugenics. And you got it. This book is probably about, I don't know, I'd actually have to look and see when that was written, but it was probably written, I'm assuming, probably around 1920. So it's you know, the book's probably about 90 years old or so. But it's really, you know, the details of good versus evil can change, but the principles really do remain the same, and a lot of the arguments that he's making, you know, it still applies to us today. And so, and this guy, this G.K. Chesterton, really had a great grasp of the arguments. So I'm going to go ahead and play this, and as I say, I'll play it for a few minutes and then I'll probably stop it. So here is Chapter 9 of that audiobook, Eugenics, from LibriVox.org.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Eugenics and Other Evils by G.K. Chesterton. Section 9, Part 2, The Real Aim, Chapter 1, The Impotence of Impenitence. The root formula of an epic is always an unwritten law, just as the law that is the first of all laws, that which protects life from the murderer, is written nowhere in the statute book. Nevertheless, there is all the difference between having and not having a notion of this basic assumption in an epic. For instance, the Middle Ages will simply puzzle us with their charities and cruelties, their asceticism and bright colors, unless we catch their general eagerness for building and planning, dividing this from that by walls and fences, the spirit that made architecture their most successful art. Thus, even a slave seems sacred. The divinity that did hedge a king did also, in one sense, hedge a serf, for he could not be driven out from behind his hedges. Thus even liberty became a positive thing, like a privilege, and even when most men had it, it was not opened like the freedom of a wilderness, but bestowed like the freedom of a city. Or again, the 17th century may seem a chaos of contradictions, with its almost priggish praise of parliaments and its quite barbaric massacre of prisoners, until we realize that if the Middle Ages was a house half-built, the 17th century was a house on fire. Panic was the note of it, and that fierce fastidiousness and exclusiveness that comes from fear. Calvinism was its characteristic religion even in the Catholic Church, the insistence on the narrowness of the way and the fewness of the chosen. Suspicion was the note of its politics. Put not your trust in princes. It tried to thrash everything out by learned, virulent, and ceaseless controversy, and it weeded its population by witch-burning. Or yet again, the 18th century will present pictures that seem utterly opposite and yet seem singularly typical of the time. The Sack of Versailles and the Vicar of Wakefield, the Pastorals of Watteau, and the Dynamite Speeches of Danton. But we shall understand them all better if we once catch sight of the idea of tidying up, which ran through the whole period, the quietest people being prouder of their tidiness, civilization, and sound taste than of any of their virtues, and the wildest people having, and this is the most important point, no love of wildness for its own sake, like Nietzsche or the anarchic poets, but only a readiness to employ it to get rid of unreason or disorder. With these epics, it's not altogether impossible to say that some such form of words is a key. The epic for which it is almost impossible to find a form of words is our own. Nevertheless, I think that with us the key word is inevitability, or, as I should be inclined to call it, impenitence. We are subconsciously dominated in all departments by the notion that there is no turning back, and it is rooted in materialism and the denial of free will. Take any handful of modern facts and compare them with the corresponding facts a few hundred years ago. Compare the modern party system with the political factions of the 17th century. The difference is that in the older time, the party leaders not only really cut off each other's heads, but, what is much more alarming, really repealed each other's laws. With us, it has become traditional for one party to inherit and leave untouched the acts of the other when made, however bitterly they were attacked in the making. James II and his nephew William were neither of them very gay specimens, but they would have laughed at the idea of a continuous foreign policy. The Tories were not conservatives. They were, in the literal sense, reactionaries. They did not merely want to keep the Stuarts. They wanted to bring them back. Or again, consider how obstinately the English medieval monarchy returned again and again to its vision of French possessions, trying to reverse the decision of fate. How Edward III returned to the charge after the defeats of John and Henry III, and Henry V after the failure of Edward III. And how even Mary had that written on her heart which was neither her husband nor her religion. And then consider this, that we have comparatively lately known a universal orgy of the thing called imperialism, the unity of the empire, the only topic. Colonies counted like crown jewels, and the Union Jack waved across the world. And yet no one so much as dreamed, I will not say, of recovering the American colonies for the imperial unity, which would have been too dangerous a task for modern empire builders, but even of retelling the story from an imperial standpoint. Henry V justified the claims of Edward III. Joseph Chamberlain would not have dreamed of justifying the claims of George III. Shakespeare justifies the French War and sticks to Talbot and deifies the legend of Joan of Arc. Mr. Kipling would not dare to justify the American War, stick to Burgoyne, and defy the legend of Washington. Yet there really was much more to be said for George III than there ever was for Henry V. It was not said, much less acted upon, by the modern imperialist, because of this basic modern sense that, as the future is inevitable, so is the past irrevocable. Any fact so complete as the American exodus from the empire must be considered as final for eons, though it hardly happened more than 100 years ago. Merely because it has managed to occur, it must be called first a necessary evil, and then an indispensable good. I need not add that I do not want to reconquer America, but then I am not an imperialist.
Okay, so I'll go ahead and cut that off there. That is Chapter 9 from Eugenics by G.K. Chesterton. While that was playing, I actually looked that up. That was published in 1917. And so that book is almost 100 years old. But it's, some people might think that, you know, it's kind of dry material, but it's really not. It's really, I find it extremely interesting and... So, you know, the arguments that he makes, I mean, they really pertain to us today. And it's really quite a good book. So, but some of that, you know, some of these books, you know, they're, of course, that LibriVox, they've got just all kinds of different books. The only prerequisite is that the copyright has to have expired. So that's why you've got a lot of older books, but you've got classics like Moby Dick and so on and so forth, books like that. But I don't really care so much about nonfiction stuff as I do something like this, because this is more an observational type of book, and observations don't change. You know, if someone's observing, if they're observing behavior and observing principles of behavior, those don't change, regardless of what people would like you to think. Human behavior does not change as far as the principles and, you know, motivations and what have you. That remains exactly the same, and so that the language may change a little bit. You can listen to this. Now, this guy was British, and so in the book he talks quite a bit about British society and so on and so forth, but you can kind of tell that the language is different and our language has changed, because the words he uses are quite a bit more flowery than what we would than what we typically use today. But nonetheless, it hasn't changed that much, and you can, again, you know, I'm really enjoying being able to listen to this, because I read, I don't know, probably about halfway through it, and then the problem I have is reading time. I don't necessarily have a whole lot of time to just sit and read, but it, you know, in an audio form, obviously I've got all kinds of driving time from day to day, and that enables me to, you know, really listen to a lot of different stuff. And if I'm going to kind of nix the news, I don't know how many, you know, how many books this LibriVox has, but they've probably, I'm assuming thousands anyway. And so I've, you know, I'm going to start kind of poking around, and, you know, and then there's a wealth of information about G.K. Chesterton, and, you know, on Wikipedia that, you know, I just kind of looked at. The guy wrote 80 books, and he did write nonfiction books, and as well as fiction and fantasy, and, you know, so he wrote a bunch of different types of books. So there should be a lot of stuff available, you know, and that's just one author. And, you know, so there's plenty of stuff to listen to. So I'm going to really kind of enjoy the LibriVox. You know, I got the app for my phone. I'm sure there's also probably an iPod or an iPad version of that as well. So if you're looking for something to listen to, check out LibriVox, LibriVox .org. So, anyway, I think I'm going to go ahead and cut this off and see if I can get it uploaded, and then get headed to bed. I got up at, it was 3:30 a.m. this morning when I got up, my time. So I've been going to bed early and then getting up early past several days. So that's just kind of the way it's worked out. So anyhow, hope everyone is having a great week. Weekend's almost here. So I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.